It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Rick Brewer, in for Ben Kiefer. During times of crisis and uncertainty, people gravitate toward history for context and understanding. This pandemic has been no exception. For months now, there is a newfound interest in the history of hospitals, caregiving, and what it means to be charitable. And perhaps most of all, people want to know what life was like during previous pandemics in world history. Historian Adam Davis is my guest this hour, whose new book, The Medieval Economy of Salvation, Charity, Commerce, and the Rise of the Hospital, will help us unpack the history of hospitals and caregiving in medieval Europe and show you that this period in history, the medieval period, might not be as primitive as you might have thought going into this conversation. Davis is a professor of history and the director of the Liska Center for Scholarly Engagement at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. Adam Davis, welcome to River to River.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's great to be with you.
And in the spirit of full disclosure, I have to say that Adam was my advisor and mentor when I was a student at Denison. But Adam, I've known about this project for years now. I remember when you talked about it in class. But it's been a long haul to, you know, to complete this book over 10 years. Let's go back to the very beginning. What is the origin story of how you even got interested in studying medieval hospitals?
Well, I, while working on my first book, which was called The Holy Bureaucrat, which was a study of a fascinating medieval archbishop in northern France in the 13th century, I was making use of an incredible document that he kept over 21 years, a register, kind of a diary of what he did every day. And he conducted visitations. He would visit churches and monasteries and hospitals for the poor and the sick, and sort of inspect people's conduct, make sure the finances were in order and so forth. And so this piqued my interest. I was very curious about these medieval hospitals, how they got started, the people behind them who founded them and patronized them, worked in them, and those that they cared for. So that really is what kind of opened the door, what raised a lot of questions for me and led to this new book.
And in your introduction, you talked about a research trip that you made to France when you were just at the early stages back in 2010. And if you could please read a passage from that introduction from back in 2010 for us.
Sure. It was a cold winter evening in 2010, and I had just arrived in Paris for a short research trip. The tiny hotel where I would be staying was on the fifth floor of the ophthalmological wing of the Hôtel Dieu, or hospital, just across from the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Given the subject of the book I was in France to research, it seemed appropriate that I should stay in a hospital hotel, especially since some medieval hospitals not only housed the sick and poor, but also functioned as hotels that charged their guests based on the length of their visits. As the TripAdvisor reviews warned, guests in this hotel often shared the elevator with patients in wheelchairs or on gurneys. When I arrived at the entrance to the hospital, however, what struck me was the large number of homeless Parisians who were using the hospital's heated foyer as a shelter for the night. I remember thinking that if this had been the 13th century, these homeless people, rather than relegated to the foyer, would have been admitted to the Hôtel Dieu and given a bed and a meal after they had confessed their sins.
Fascinating. I remember when you talked about going on these trips that you're sort of transported into a different world, and there's sort of this clash of worlds and being in a place that you're actually studying. How has that shaped how you have approached this book?
It's a good question. You know, the main reason that we go on these kinds of trips is to get access to documents, medieval documents, manuscripts, most of which have not been digitized. Many of them have not been cataloged. You never really know exactly what you're going to find, which makes it a little more exciting, although it can also be frustrating when you don't find the elusive source that you really are hoping to find. But it's true that even apart from the archives and those kinds of written sources, you do have those kinds of chance encounters where being in the place helps you visualize what the past might have been like. So for instance, one of the things that I have been interested in while working on this book was to try to visit some medieval hospitals where the structure is still exists, and in some cases has not changed much in the last 800 years. One example in northern France of a medieval hospital that today is being used as a kind of community center for a town where they have concerts and that kind of thing. But when you go in the main hall, or what was the central ward of this hospital, which again today is used for a very different purpose, you can see the little nooks in the wall where the beds were attached, which enables you to get a sense of like how many beds there were, you know, how many guests or patients was this hospital able to house. And so those kinds of things are very, very useful for the historian.
Right. It's so much better than accessing the archives online through PDFs. You know, it's very visceral.
Exactly.
in a lot of ways. Let's just talk about the origin of the word hospital, because when I came across this in the book, I was kind of shocked, because I went into it thinking hospital is strictly a medical term, but that's not the case here.
No, that's right. One of the things that I show in the book was just the surprising diversity of roles and functions that medieval hospitals played, not only taking in sick people, but very often poor people with various kinds of needs, orphans, widows, people with specific ailments, but also merchant travelers looking for a place to spend a few nights, maybe there for a trade fair, pilgrims who are on a religious pilgrimage also needing a place to stay. And the word, our word, English word, hospital, comes from the Latin word hospes, which means guest or visitor. And the words, you know, hospital, hospitality, hospice, even hostel, are all related to that Latin word for hospital that's connected to hospitality and welcoming guests.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the aspects of the medieval hospital, you studied many different characteristics of it. Let's just talk about some of the areas in which you focused on in this book.
Well, some of the main questions I was interested in asking had to do with a commercial economy that was very much on the rise, a commercial revolution during the 12th and 13th centuries. And so I was interested in the question of what happens to the meaning of gifts and gift giving in an emerging commercial economy. Was the power of the gift eroded in some ways? And I found that quite the opposite. It actually took on new social and religious meaning. And the rise of the hospital as an institution is very closely tied to that charitable revolution that itself is tied to a commercial revolution. So that was one big question. I was also interested in sort of the fundamental question of why medieval people gave and served. What was the meaning of giving and serving, both in the religious context in which it was seen as a kind of form of penance, a way to earn salvation through good works, but also the ways in which givers and those who worked in hospitals were, looking for a way to earn credit. Perhaps the hospital could repay them in some way, either by taking care of them, but also the fact that hospitals were serving as landlords, were lending money, functioning as banks. So there were a lot of different kinds of roles. And there were reasons that a family member might be thanking a hospital for some service it had provided a family member. And then thirdly, I would say just this larger question of the roles that hospitals played, very different from our notion of just a medicalized institution today. And so I was interested in investigating just what those roles were and in the economy and in the larger society.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is Adam Davis. He's a professor of history and the director of the Liska Center for Scholarly Engagement at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. He's also the author of the new book, which is the subject of our discussion this hour. The book is titled The Medieval Economy of Salvation, charity, commerce, and the rise of the hospital. Let's unpack these a little bit more. Take me to a medieval hospital as best you can for radio. If we were to walk in and you were my tour guide, what would one of these medieval hospitals look like? What would I be seeing? Who would be there?
Well, it's a great question, Rick. And of course, there's a lot that we still don't know, even having written this book. For one thing, they varied so much. So there were rural hospitals, urban hospitals. Pretty much every major city would, or even town would have had multiple hospitals by the 13th century all across Europe. This is something that is a pan-European phenomenon. And you would have found, by the way, hospitals in the major cities of the Islamic world, and the Eastern Greek, Byzantine, Christian world as well. So some were very, very small. They might have only had a few beds. Others could be quite large and have maybe 100 beds inside them. But we do know that there was certainly attention paid to things that we might not expect. When we think we might expect a medieval hospital would have been a sordid, dirty, unhygienic place. But in fact, a great deal of attention was paid to water. They were generally located on major sources of water along rivers. Attention was paid to ventilation. You can see that they had very often high, tall windows and ways of accessing those windows to be able to open them and close them and bring in light. In some cases, gardens, even music may have been considered part of the healing process and palliative care. So all of these things would have been, I think, striking to us. And then in terms of who's populating them, who's working in them, who's being cared inside these institutions, that, again, tremendous amount of variety. So in terms of social class, gender, many of these were religious institutions in the sense that either they were founded by clergy or were run by religious or semi-religious women and men, even if they were founded by ordinary lay people, not priests, not monks. So we would have seen serfs working in the fields, cultivating crops, grain and wine, bakeries, people cleaning the linens. So again, the need for water, not just for hygienic purposes, but well, for hygienic purposes, for the sheets and so forth. So a lot of activity. And then hospitals were also quite active outside the hospital walls in terms of caring for the poor and the sick, even those who were not admitted, who were not living there, but they would go and seek out those who needed a distribution of some coins or clothing. So they were very much a presence in urban areas.
Mm. I think what struck me about what your description there that I think might have struck some of the people listening to this right now is that these medieval hospitals were a lot more sophisticated than we might think of, because when we think, if people who know anything about the Middle Ages, it's often depicted as the dark times, plague, death, disorganization, dysfunction, but that these hospitals, like so many things from the medieval world, but we'll just stick to hospitals for right now, it was more sophisticated than we would think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about the Middle Ages, grounded in some reality. Certainly, you know, it was a time of crusades and violence against Muslims and Jews and heretics and so forth. But I think you're mentioning the word, you know, order, organization. Those are really important concepts that people don't usually associate with this period. And yet it was a period of the creation and development of new institutions, of Renaissance in the 12th century in terms of learning and culture and literature and order in a lot of way of rules and administration. And you see that with these hospitals, many of which did have statutes or rules that were drawn up, and lots of discussion about who had jurisdiction over them and who could enforce these rules, and a desire to make sure that the sick and the poor who were being cared for were being cared for properly, and that there wasn't neglect of those who were the object of the founders of these hospitals.
Something else that really struck me when I read your book was that, getting back to what you said earlier about, you know, the word hospital and hotel sort of being one and the same, but also that a hospital was a place where somebody could rent a room. It, like, you know, you landlord, you know, you could live there. Talk about that aspect, because I think that's something that most people do not think of when they think hospital, that it has a history of housing people.
Yeah, no, that's right. And this was, by the way, a subject of some debate at the time, because there were critics within the church primarily who were quite unhappy that hospitals were caring for others besides the sick and the poor. And they thought, why do you have merchants staying over? That's not what your hospital should be for. So it was the subject of criticism. But hospitals often were landlords, not just in terms of who is living for a short period inside the hospital, but they owned property. They owned, in some cases, dozens and dozens of buildings that they would rent out, land, mills, tolls, where they would charge people for going over a bridge. So there were lots of surprising sources of revenue that hospitals had. But also, as you say, you had them seeing an opportunity to sort of rent out a room in the hospital. You sometimes had wealthy, aristocratic women who maybe lost a husband later in life and decided as a widow to spend their last years in a hospital. They would give themselves and their property to the hospital, and they wouldn't take monastic vows, but they would want to be associated with the works of mercy that were being performed there, and they would live there, and maybe they would assist the nurses, the brothers and sisters who were performing nursing functions. So again, not just the sick, not just the poor who you would have found inside a medieval hospital.
Right. And lay women, the average woman, if you will, did have a role in these hospitals. It wasn't just strictly men of means. And you cited several statistics about who was giving to these hospitals. So talk about the larger role women, both lay women, your average woman, or your aristocratic woman, you know, played in the medieval hospital life world.
Yes. Well, they certainly played a very prominent role, especially in terms of caretaking, nursing, being there on the front lines, helping those who were sick or poor with their physical bodily needs. So we know that very often the number of women caretakers outnumbered men. In some cases, there weren't really men involved in a caretaking role. But we also see women figuring quite prominently as donors to hospitals. We have wills, especially from the 13th century, in large numbers. And it is quite staggering to see the frequency of bequests to hospitals and other charitable institutions by female testators, those who are, you know, composing their wills. In some cases, they're single women or widows, but in other cases, they may need the consent of a spouse, of a husband, or a brother, but we see them exercising quite a lot of agency and playing a formative role in this charitable revolution that we see happening in the 12th and 13th centuries in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to something that's in the title of the book, you know, the economy of salvation. Let's talk about how that is in conjunction to hospitals. What was the economy of salvation that you have dubbed?
Well, it goes sort of to a central idea in Christianity from the Middle Ages and much earlier, this idea that, what you do in this earthly world can earn you salvation or reduce time in purgatory in the world to come. And this idea became even more important in the 12th and 13th centuries with the development of purgatory, and the idea that purgatory was a real and terrifying place that nobody wanted to go to or spend much time at. And so this idea that charity, not just prayer or fasting, other forms of penance, but charity and charitable works, like working in a hospital or giving alms to the poor, could earn you reduced time in purgatory and help that path to salvation. That became a more and more powerful idea during this period. And one of the things that's interested me is in this period of commercial effervescence, the way in which we see economic vocabulary and economic concepts being deployed by the church, by preachers and theologians who are constantly invoking the idea of investment on return and profit and earning and so on and so forth. Some of these ideas you certainly see going back to even the New Testament itself and the early church fathers, the first centuries of Christianity, but they take on new meaning and a new kind of intensity, I think, in the 13th century because of the context of this flourishing profit economy. And there are a lot of conflicted feelings among medieval Christians about profit and certainly about usury, which was seen as a vice that in some cases a necessary vice, but the idea of interest loans. And so that was being invoked in the context of discussions about the need to be charitable and to care for one's neighbors and those who are less fortunate.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute before we have to go to a quick break here, Adam. But before we do, I want to just talk about the overall meaning of care and charity. It's so different from what we think of today, or is it kind of similar?
Well, I think that there are similarities. I think that in the hospital context, you know, we have a very narrow idea of what constitutes medical care and what medicine is. And I think they had a broader idea that included what they referred to as sacramental medicine, that receiving the sacraments was itself a kind of medicine. Preaching was a kind of medicine. And so there's a broader notion in the Middle Ages of what constitutes care than what we have today.
My guest this hour is Adam Davis. He's a professor of history and the director of the Liska Center for Scholarly Engagement at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. We're talking about his latest book, The Medieval Economy of Salvation, Charity, Commerce, and the Rise of the Hospital. In the second half of the program, we're going to talk about the parallels with our modern world between the medieval world, and we'll talk about how churches have been serving as hospitals during the pandemic and how it can be connected to big business. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Rick Brewer in for Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. Glad to have you aboard of this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Rick Brewer in for Ben Kiefer. If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is Adam Davis, professor of history and the director of the Liska Center for Scholarly Engagement at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. We're talking about his new book, The Medieval Economy of Salvation, Charity, Commerce, and the Rise of the Hospital, which talks about the world of medieval hospitals and caregiving. Adam, I'd like to continue our conversation with starting out with the story of Huguette Clark. Why don't you go ahead and just read that passage from your book?
Sure. In 1991, the copper heiress Huguette Clark was admitted to Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City for what was a relatively minor illness. Clark ended up staying at the hospital for 20 years, dying there in 2011 at the age of 104. The hospital had been ready to discharge her a few weeks after she was first admitted, but as it happened, her three Manhattan apartments, worth tens of millions of dollars, were being renovated, and she found that living at the hospital was to her liking. She didn't have difficulty persuading the hospital to let her stay, although it's likely that no one anticipated that her stay would last for 20 years. Seeing an opportunity in Huguette Clark, however, the development office of Beth Israel Medical Center launched an aggressive fundraising campaign. The hospital did research on Clark to learn, in the words of one of its development officers, an appropriate cultivation approach. It showered her with gifts, including compact discs, chocolates, homemade pies, playing cards from Paris, birthday balloons, and Easter baskets. The mother of the hospital's CEO was sent to sit with Clark in her hospital room, talk about her rare doll collection, and watch The Smurfs with her, her favorite TV show, while gently broaching the subject of her will. As the hospital's lawyer put it, Beth Israel provided Mrs. Clark with a well-attended home where she was able to live out her days in security, relative good health and comfort, and with the pleasures of human company. Huguette Clark ended up giving at least $4 million in donations to Beth Israel, as well as an additional bequest of $1 million in her will, and she spent close to $500,000 a year for room and board at the hospital. Although we tend to think of the modern hospital exclusively in terms of medical care, the example of Huguette Clark is a reminder of the more distant past when hospitals served a diversity of functions and housed a wide range of people, including those without a support network and those who used hospitals as inns, paying room and board to stay there.
Wow. Yeah. I remember that passage really jumped out at me. And then what else can you tell us about Huguette Clark? Is she an exception to this rule, or are there more Huguettes in the world? in sort of our modern world, I should say.
Yeah, I have no idea. That's a good question. But when I read this account in the New York Times a few years ago about her, I thought, wow, you know, this sounds so medieval in some ways, being that I was studying medieval hospitals at the time and knew that there were lots of examples. It was actually not uncommon in the 13th century and 14th century for especially a wealthy woman like Huguette Clark to do this very kind of thing, to be maybe lonely, to be wanting to be associated with the charitable function of a hospital, and to basically the Latin phrase was that they would legally give themselves and their things to the hospital and then live there. And so I didn't know if Huguette Clark was an anomaly. I certainly wasn't familiar with this kind of thing happening, but I found it to be a kind of fascinating parallel in some ways with what I was working on.
Yeah, for people who are going to pick up the book after this conversation, it is pretty fascinating, the parallel of Huguette Clark's story with the rest of the book. It is very medieval, as you put, Adam. But on the topic of giving, one of the central questions to your book is asking, why did people give to these hospitals? And with the example of Huguette Clark is a modern parallel, but let's go back to the medieval world for a second here. Why were people giving to these hospitals?
Well, I think that, first of all, people were very much interested in supporting the charitable mission of hospitals, namely to provide assistance to those with needs, the sick, the poor, those with various kinds of dependencies, disabilities, and so forth. It was in vogue. It was sort of a popular thing to do at the time. People of all different social classes. So this was not just the wealthy, the aristocracy, ordinary townspeople, in some cases even peasants who had a means to give did so. And we see at this time that rather than giving being something that was the preoccupation of high-level church officials or monasteries, which had actually housed the sick and poor in infirmaries going back many centuries, and bishops had played a role also in housing the sick. Now it was the laity, and it was sort of democratized giving. So some of this was very much just wanting to be associated with what hospitals stood for. I do think it was also related to guilt about this new profit economy in the 12th and 13th centuries. It, by giving away one's wealth, it sort of justified wealth. It made wealth be virtuous, or having the capacity to be virtuous rather than sinful. And certainly this was a time when avarice was seen as one of the cardinal sins that people wanted to avoid. But there were also ways in which you wanted to earn the favor of a hospital, since hospitals did a lot of things besides caring for those with needs. And so we have many examples of hospitals giving loans to people, lending money like a bank. And so you might have been wanting to thank a hospital for some service, financial service that it had provided to you or to a family member. Following a gift, very often hospitals and monasteries did this as well, would give what we refer to as a counter gift to express the hospital's gratitude for your gift. And a little bit like public radio giving the the tote bag, right, it's NPR on it. And as a symbol of this bond between NPR and the giver, the donor, or they read your name on air. So there was something similar happening in the Middle Ages where religious institutions like hospitals and monasteries would give some kind of a token gift, a gesture to solidify that bond and to encourage future giving. And so it was kind of an exchange of back and forth, gift, counter gift.
Seems like a nice segue into this is sort of the origin of how, of a lot of the ways of modern hospitals, because as you mentioned in your epilogue, sort of the 20th and 21st century hospitals, you know, a lot of the times harken back to this type of giving and enterprise, and how hospitals have become big business. And a lot of ways they don't make their primary revenue stream is not medical care. So let's jump into that parallel here for a second there.
Sure. Yeah, I know. Of course, this has been very much in the news just in the last few days and weeks because of the pandemic and the fact that hospitals, like many institutions, are receiving, in some cases, very large sums of money from the federal government in response to the pandemic. And so we're learning about some of these hospital chains, truly big business, even though they're technically nonprofits that are exempt from paying, in many cases, federal taxes. And yet we've learned not only how much they're receiving from the federal government, but the fact that in some cases they're sitting on many billions of dollars of cash and investing in hedge funds and running venture capital funds and so forth. And as you say, much of their annual revenue comes from investments as opposed to treating patients. So it's this side of medieval hospitals that I was also trying to kind of highlight, that in order to fulfill their mission, they felt the need to be investing in various kinds of ways and trying to find sources of revenue beyond just charitable donations. And so in some cases, they were very successful. Other hospitals, not at all, and we're not actually able to make those kinds of investments. And of course, today too, there are many hospitals that are struggling and that are actually folding because of the loss of revenue during the pandemic. So there are some parallels there, and certainly this idea of hospitals as embodying big business that we see in the 21st century was also the case in some cases in the 13th century in Europe.
And it's interesting because you've been working on this project for over 10 years now, and you wrote that epilogue probably a year ago or not too long. You know, now there's all this attention on it. There's sort of this new refound interest that I sort of mentioned at the beginning of our discussion. Talk about that sensation as sort of a medieval historian now that we're seeing headlines in the New York Times here, quote, "Like Europe in medieval times, virus slows China's economy." So as a medieval historian, this sort of resurgence and corresponding with the publication of this book, what has that been like for you?
Yeah, it's a sort of sad moment in some ways for medievalists, and yet bittersweet that there's renewed interest in the medieval past, above all, the most catastrophic pandemic in human history, the Black Death from the 14th century. And there's been a lot of groundbreaking work in recent years on the Black Death and taking a much more global perspective on that pandemic. But now, suddenly, I think a lot of medieval historians, such as myself, will all be teaching a course in colleges and universities on the Black Death, because there's so much interest in that natural disaster. But you're right. Suddenly there's renewed focus on hospitals, on the sacrifices that the frontline workers, nurses, and doctors have been making in the last few months and make all the time, but especially now. And so it's been a little bit surprising for me to suddenly see some of these parallels that weren't quite as stark before COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Also want to talk about another parallel here that we've seen since the pandemic came. You wrote an article for conversation.com back in March when the pandemic was really starting to get going. We saw churches setting up field hospitals in Central Park. We also saw an example in Alaska. And you say in the article, we haven't seen this since the 1918 flu pandemic, but actually this has been going around for quite a long time, actually.
Yeah, you know, what really sparked my interest in this was when I read that the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, which is one of the largest cathedrals in the world, was being transformed into a field hospital. They were going to set up several hundred beds. The plan ended up being scrapped, but they had already begun setting up the beds in the cathedral. And it just got me thinking about this long history going back to, well, the U.S. Civil War, when churches were treating wounded soldiers, and going all the way back to the Middle Ages, when for many, many centuries, it was standard for monasteries to have an infirmary where the sick, both the sick among the monks or nuns were cared for, but also lay people would come to be treated or convalesce. And bishops and their cathedrals often had hospitals attached or nearby that the cathedral would serve. And so this long, long history of religious institutions, churches, being connected not only as physical spaces serving as hospitals, but hospital care and medical care. I mean, there's a reason that so many hospitals in the U.S. Are named after saints, are run by the Catholic Church or various Protestant churches. So there's a long, long, long history there. And it seemed very appropriate that the cathedral in New York City was going to serve temporarily as a hospital. And then reading that was happening in other places, like, as you mentioned, in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the phrases of 2020, when we look back on this history, is going to be, you know, sorry, thought I was on mute. Another phrase is going to be quarantine. You know, quarantine is a very medieval word. And you talk about in this article from conversation.com about how, you know, priests had heard confessions from a distance. There was practices of quarantine and social distancing. Talk about some of those parallels that we've seen today that we've sort of had to adopt in 2020 that people in the Middle Ages were also doing.
Yeah, no, I think I often think about the fact that we tend to look back and sometimes with some snobbery at the past and think that we're better and no better and they were primitive and so forth. And but it has been interesting to see when the pandemic first hit and all the attention was on China. Initially, there was quite a lot of criticism of the Chinese authorities. There's continued to be criticism, certainly, but of the steps that China was taking to contain the virus, and quarantining that had a negative connotation and was right away branded as, boy, China has gone medieval. And it's been interesting to see how our attitude towards quarantining has evolved in the West. And there's been a shift where we've come to accept that as necessary and as a positive thing. And as you mentioned, that idea and that word was something that was born in medieval Italy when efforts were made when a ship would arrive at an Italian port to require that those on the ship stay on the ship for a certain number of weeks to ensure that they were not going to transmit any pathogens to the local community. And so, you know, this idea that there was no public health system or ideas about public health in the Middle Ages is totally erroneous. And in fact, there's a new book that shows that these ideas about public health were actually quite sophisticated even before the Black Death, before the mid-1300s. And so I think it's been humbling and sort of sobering for us as we've tried as a society and a world to figure out how to manage, how to navigate through this pandemic and figure out what is this virus and how does it operate? Right. I mean, just on a fundamental level, there's so much that we don't know because it's new. And so too, in the distant past, there were new bacteria and new viruses that would arrive, and even some that weren't new, but people were trying to figure out how to manage.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is Adam Davis. He's a professor of history and the director of the Liska Center for Scholarly Engagement at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. We've been talking about his new book, The Medieval Economy of Salvation: Charity, Commerce, and the Rise of the Hospital. We've also been talking about how a lot of the pandemic in the world that we currently find ourselves living in has so many parallels with our current situation. Now, Adam, in the few minutes that we have left, I wanted to talk about some of the takeaways that you want people to maybe walk away with, or what they should look into if they pick up your book. What do you want people to learn from reading your book?
Well, one, I think it's important that people have some awareness of this charitable revolution in the Middle Ages. As we talked a little bit about earlier, that's not what comes to mind for most people when they think about medieval Europe. But I think it's a fascinating aspect of medieval society that deserves greater attention. And I wanted to shed some new light on the origins of this institution that we kind of take for granted, the hospital, which has had a long, long history and a very important sort of reinvention of this institution during the Middle Ages. But the other sort of major theme of the book that I think there's an important lesson for us has to do with the complex interplay between charity or philanthropy and commerce and the economy. And I think we often tend to think of those things as diametrically opposed, that charity was kind of anti-market in its very nature, unlike modern philanthropy and what now is being called philanthrocapitalism, which has based on this idea of harnessing the profit motive and market forces in the service of philanthropy. But in fact, there's a much longer history there too, as I show in the book, that even in the Middle Ages, in a kind of proto-capitalist society, where there were very much ideas and motives of wanting to make a profit and grow one's wealth, at the same time, there was a desire to sort of marry that objective with the objective to be altruistic and to make a difference and assist those with various kinds of needs. And so that's not a new ideal, and it's a complicated ideal, as various people have shown in recent years, the sort of dark underbelly of philanthrocapitalism. That was true in the 12th and 13th centuries as well. And so I was wanting to call attention to that and sort of explore that complex interplay between the economy and charity.
In just about 30 or 40 seconds that we have left, what's next for you now that we're sort of living in this new world? How has that changed? Are you working on studying more about the Black Death, as you mentioned, as a medievalist? What is next for you?
Well, I am teaching a little mini course this summer for Denison students on the Black Death, but my research interests are likely going to be moving in a quite different direction, and I plan to write a cultural history of ambition in the Middle Ages. So that's what's next.
Adam, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
My guest this hour has been Adam Davis, professor of history and the director of the Liska Center for Scholarly Engagement at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. His new book, The Medieval Economy of Salvation: Charity, Commerce, and the Rise of the Hospital. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Matt Alvarez, and me. Dennis Reese runs our soundboard. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Never miss an episode of River to River by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it in your favorite podcast app. or find a full archive of all of our shows at iowapublicradio.org. Also, send us an email. We always love hearing from listeners. Send us your comments and story ideas to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer will be back tomorrow with a News Buzz edition of River to River. He'll check in with IPR's Natalie Krebs about the latest news from Governor Reynolds on the pandemic in the state of Iowa, and speak with a reporter from Storm Lake about a recent outbreak of COVID-19 in Buena Vista County. I'm Rick Brewer, in for Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.